Welcome back to Karen's Couch, and welcome to this week's episode. Now, this week, as every other week, but this week is kind of a little bit special because it's a bit of a follow-on from last week. If you listened to the show or you watched it, you'll know that we had the amazing friend of mine, Michael McQueen, join us talking about Generation X, Generation Y, the baby boomers, and now the up-and-coming Generation Zs. Now, looking at that and hearing everything that Michael was talking about, it kind of made me put two and two together on our teenagers and how they're feeling, because it really made me think about the disconnect between Generation X and Generation Y. Are we both misunderstood? And if we look at our teenagers and our younger generation, you know, the depression rates in our younger people, it's massive. It's absolutely huge. So I figured it was something that we needed to have a look at. We needed to dive deep into this one to just analyze what's causing it. What's causing depression in our teenagers? So when we did the research and we put the feelers out, we came up with one of the most outspoken clinical psychologists by the name of Dr. Michael Yapko. And he's got this amazing philosophy around teenage depression and his belief about how depression could very well be contagious. I want to know everything that this man knows. I want to hear his point of view and I want to share it with you. So welcome Dr. Michael Yapko to Karen's Couch with me today. So join me in welcoming Michael Yapko to the couch. Thank you so much for being a part of Karen's Couch today, Dr. Michael Yapko. It's an absolute treat to have you with us, because even just talking with you off air has been not only insightful, but incredibly inspiring. And your view on depression, and particularly teenage depression, it's so thought-provoking, but it's very compelling in terms of, have we got it right or have we missed the mark? So, Michael, tell us about your experience. Tell us about what you see and what your experience has been with teenage depression.
Well, my experience is on multiple levels. As a clinical psychologist, I do treatment. So for almost 40 years now, I've been working with families and watching what's called the transgenerational risk factors at work. How is it that young people end up being more depressed statistically than their parents? We know that the child of a depressed parent is anywhere from 3 to 6 times more likely to become depressed than the child of a non-depressed parent. And so in working with families, you can literally see how this transmission is taking place. And then also as an author and researcher, you know, I write books and I research books. And so beyond my own clinical practice, I have a much stronger sense of what's going on around the world. Mm. I have taught now in more than 30 countries across 6 continents, and I'm very curious about what's called the cross-national epidemiology. How does depression differ in Australia compared to the United States, compared to Spain, compared to Iceland, compared to pick a country, Japan?
Yeah.
So we accumulate those kinds of data about the different rates of depression, the different appearances of depression, whether it's affecting adults more, kids more, whether it's showing up more as physical or medical complaints, or whether it's showing up more as emotional difficulties. So there are a lot of different levels of analysis that we can talk about during our time together. But certainly the thing that's most compelling that I think is of concern for all of us is seeing that the rate of depression is increasing in every age group around the world, according to the World Health Organization. And when we look at the demographics, the largest group of depression sufferers are the 25 to 44-year-olds. And, of course, they share many common characteristics. But one of the characteristics that they share is that they're in their prime childbearing years.
Yes.
And so it's very interesting that you have the largest group of depression sufferers raising what are now the fastest growing group of depression sufferers, namely their children.
So it's contagious.
Depression is contagious, and funny you should mention that. That's the title of my last book on depression.
Oh, look at that.
depression is contagious in a social sense, that we learn the coping skills or not from other people. We learn the problem solving skills or not from other people. We learn social skills or not from other people. And so the kinds of factors that set people up of any age, teens included, to be depressed are socially acquired or not. And so it, from my perspective, what I'm always looking at is what are known as the risk factors, the vulnerabilities. What are the things that happen in a family? What are the things that happen in a culture that increase the likelihood of people suffering depression as a result of being a member of that group?
So when we look at depression from that perspective, and that there's potential that it's contagious and it's a social issue, what are some of the contributing factors? If a parent is depressed, then it's much more likely that their child is going to be depressed.
Yes.
What other contributing factors are there that would escalate that depression in that age group?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing that if you look at the age at which parents lose control of their children. You know, when I was growing up, the average epidemiologist told us was around 16. Yeah. Now they're estimating that it's around age 11. So while we used to say that, you know, parents were such a predominant force, parents have actually become less forceful in shaping their kids' views. And it's more about technology and other kids shaping kids' viewpoints. And the kind of factors that have been operating today are factors that have no precedent. We didn't grow up with the influence of technology the way that kids do. You know, these kids today who are texting literally hundreds of times per day, these kids who are spending hour after hour after hour in front of computer screens and iPhones and everything else, it has a human impact. You know, we certainly have enough evidence to show that the more time these kids spend with technology, the worse they tend to feel and the less they have the kinds of social skills that really make a difference. You know, you can't learn to read people's motives in a text. Mm. You can't hear the sarcasm in their voice in a text. Mm. You can't see the expression on their face in a text. And the little emoticons aren't going to help you when it comes time to actually dealing sensibly with other people. Mm. So kids are at an actual disadvantage, and they face these kinds of issues that we've never faced. Cyberbullying is a huge force in teenagers' lives.
Yes.
The fact that, you know, when I was growing up, if you had a problem with another kid at school, at least when the school day was over, you got to go home and you know, that was it.
Yeah.
Today, they have access to hurt you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Absolutely.
By posting anything that's brutal, anything that's cruel, anything that's embarrassing. And there's just no escaping the kind of influence that cyberbullying has. But another factor is the family. From my standpoint, what troubles me the most is how often kids view themselves, because they've come to be viewed by their families, as burdensome. That you have, you know, the only way I can say it is you have a generation of people who wanted to have kids, they just didn't want to be parents.
Explain that. What do you mean by that?
They wanted to have kids, but they didn't want the responsibilities that go along with raising kids. They don't like that the kids are cutting into their lifestyle. They don't like it that the kids require round-the-clock attention. And particularly when they're struggling with their own depression, the burdens of having to constantly be involved with your kid. I mean, let's face it, parenting is not a job for the faint of heart. If you are not fully aware of what your kids are watching on television, if you don't know what websites they're visiting, if you don't know what videos they're watching, if you don't know what music they're listening to, if you don't know what video games they're playing, you're not doing your job. And what happens?
It's a big call, isn't it?
You're too depressed to do your job, or you're too self-absorbed to do your job. So you've got a lot of kids that are basically being raised by appliances and kind of missing the human touch there.
And so tell me about that side of things, in that have you discovered that through your research and through the patients that you've dealt with? that's like a common issue that occurs in families that are struggling with depression amongst themselves?
Absolutely. You know, life is tough for everybody these days. The economy is difficult, people losing their jobs, the stresses, the competition, the all the things that are making life difficult, external threats to our security and safety. And so, you know, most people are struggling. Most people are not having a really easy time.
I agree with you there.
And so when you have people who are struggling, the stresses mount. Stress is definitely a catalyst, an exacerbator for depression for people who don't manage stress very well. Mm-hmm. And they can easily take it out on themselves, take it out on other people, get off into negative copings, things like drinking and taking drugs kinds of things. And so what I really mean then is you have people who just aren't as available to function as parents in the way that they need to be. And so when you have kids then who are pretty much left on their own, whose parents haven't been involved to the degree that they should, and you know, and again, it's not meant to make parents feel guilty as much as it is to say that it's important to get connected if you're not and stay connected if you are. And to be the antidepressant family is, to me, the most important thing. And if you're going to do that, there are ways that you can soften the pressures. You know, the importance of having family time together cannot be overstated. Mm. You know, plenty of evidence to show that even just sharing meals together makes a big difference in family stability and individual stability. But having family rituals, you know, things that you do together, that this is where we share the events of the day and talk about how our day was with each other, or this is what we do on birthdays, or this is what we do on Saturday mornings for breakfast, or this is, you know, the kinds of family rituals that bring people together.
And create meaningful memories also, Michael, you're very outspoken about the role that medication has played in depression, and I'm super keen to explore that with you. One of the questions that I also want to ask you before we go there is this: we had Professor Gordon Parker on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he was making distinctions between what depression is and what is melancholy or a sense of sadness or loneliness that most people at some point go through, but they, you know, it comes in waves rather than it being a sustained sensation. And when it's a sustained sensation, it's more likely to be depression on some level. For parents, when they're looking at their children, how is a parent going to identify? Let's say the parent hasn't had depression themselves, yet they are dealing with a child that is going through dramatic mood swings, or you know, self-hate, or difficulties at school, or relating to people. How does a parent identify what is actual depression and therefore requires serious attention versus perhaps this loneliness or general sadness that humanity tends to experience? And do you agree with that view?
Well, you know, those differentiations matter to clinicians. They don't matter to people. You know, to me, calling it melancholia or calling it Ralph doesn't really matter to the kid who's suffering with it. So, you know, what I'm interested in is what is the quality of this person's experience? What are the things that they're facing that they don't know how to handle? And if it's loneliness, fine. What are the kinds of social skills this kid's going to need to develop if he or she's going to develop any meaningful friendships? If it's about being stressed out by school, then what are the skills this person's going to need to develop? What's interesting is that from a treatment perspective, when you identify what the skills are that people are missing and provide structured means for people developing those skills, they do better. It's no coincidence that the therapies that have the highest treatment success rates are all therapies that teach different kinds of skills. So one of those is the cognitive behavioral therapy, which teaches people how to think more clearly and how to use information more skillfully. The interpersonal model of treatment, which emphasizes the importance of relationships and social skills. So, you know, there's no one pathway into depression. There's no one pathway out. But certainly what we do know is that the more active the treatment is, the more it requires skill building opportunities and provides means for building those skills, people do better. And that's particularly true, not just from a treatment perspective, but you know, when I started studying depression 40 years ago, we couldn't say very much about treatment and we couldn't say anything about prevention. And now all these years later, we have taken these treatment strategies of active skill building approaches and applied them preventively. We've integrated them into schools and been able to demonstrate that when kids learn these skills, they have much lower incidences of depression. And when they do suffer depression, the depressions are much less severe and of shorter duration. Yeah. Prevention works. And you can't drug people preventively. And that's one of the limitations of the pill popping approach, is that that's a mop up approach. It's not a prevention approach.
I just want to tattoo that on my forehead. I think that is absolute gold, that you cannot drug people preventatively. That's absolute gold. And also too, you know, your distinction of depression there, it's not just about what is depression and let's define it. It's about the experience for the person. And if the person is suffering, the person is suffering. Bottom line, what are we going to do about that? Is it a case of medicating?
The fact that you give this person a label, unfortunately, for a lot of people, then all they do is wear the label.
It's true. You live into the diagnosis.
You know, the people who fall into a rut and then start to decorate it.
So what is your view on medication and the drugs for the treatment of this suffering?
Well, you know, the medications are not nearly as valuable as people have been led to believe. You know, if we ask the question, do these medications work, the best answer is sort of. And if you look at what's going on in the world of medications right now, the pharmaceutical industries are really quite on the defensive, because as the lawsuits mount, that there are problems with side effects, unexpected side effects, that the drugs don't work as effectively, particularly with teens, by the way. The drugs have been contraindicated because the drugs in teenagers, for unknown reasons, seem to increase the rates of suicidal thinking and even suicidal behavior. So when you look at the drug prescription labels, they tell you don't even use these drugs with people under the age of 24.
Wow.
But the point is, it's still very, there's only one drug that's been approved for use by children, and that drug is Prozac. And so the drugs, if they were safe, if they were effective, I'd be happy to advocate for them. And I will say that there are certain advantages to medications. They will provide some symptom relief for some people. But nobody should mistake for a second that this is a full treatment in and of itself, that all they have to do is take the drug and sit back and wait for it to work. And if you're interested, if people are interested, I wrote a summary paper last year that was published in one of the journals about 9 different reasons why we should be very concerned about antidepressants. And again, not so extreme as to say we shouldn't prescribe them at all, but to be able to say we shouldn't prescribe them quite so easily, quite so quickly, and quite so thoughtlessly. That these are drugs that have serious side effects. These are drugs that have potential hazards associated with them on a variety of levels. And so if someone's going to take an antidepressant, it should really be with a great deal of awareness and sensitivity to the relevant issues. And for anybody who's prescribing the drug, they are not doing the patient a favor to only prescribe the drug. Drugs have the highest rate of relapse of any form of treatment. Mm-hmm. They should be prescribed along with good psychotherapy, the kind of psychotherapy I've been talking about that teaches skills.
So what does that look like? Because a lot of people, you know, who follow the medical model will go to their doctor, and depending on who they see, that's what they get prescribed or diagnosed with.
Right.
Based on the experience of the doctor or the experience of the person who's doing the diagnosis. So what do you think is the best form of treatment that ultimately provides a long-term solution for somebody? And tell me something too, in your experience, is recovery ever possible?
Well, let's start with that first.
In remission.
recovery is absolutely possible. The problem with any problem in the mental health field is that these are ambiguous. We don't have a gene for depression that we can point to and say, there's the depression gene. We don't have this hypothetical biochemical imbalance that has yet to be proved. No one has ever proved that there's a shortage of serotonin or a shortage of norepinephrine.
Why do the doctors tell people that? Why do the doctors tell people that you have a chemical imbalance, therefore here, take Zoloft?
That has been the pharmaceutical industry's tagline for years. That's how they sell drugs. And unfortunately, I mean, this is one of the things I described in the first chapter of Depression is Contagious. The most prestigious medical journal on the planet, in most physicians' estimation, is called the Journal of the American Medical Association, or JAMA. And about 4 years ago, JAMA wrote a blistering editorial that since the drug companies had been caught in lies, deceiving people about how effective the drugs are, inflating their claims, and the journals had been duped because the drug companies had paid highly recognizable physicians to put their name on drug company research, a practice called ghostwriting. And JAMA wrote an editorial that just blasted the drug companies, and they did a mea culpa saying, we've let ourselves be duped in publishing this research that is then disseminated to physicians. So physicians think they're reading current research, they think they're reading non-biased research, and as it turns out, they're reading contaminated research and unfortunately buying into it.
And so, therefore, the patient is the person who's right, paying the price.
Right. So that controversy is reaching its zenith at this very moment. This is what's going on in the world of the pharmaceuticals right now. And I think you'll be hearing over the next few years, it takes a while for information to disseminate, but I would predict that over the next few years you're going to be hearing physicians being less enthusiastic about prescribing these drugs and becoming more enthusiastic about encouraging people to get active, structured help that can really teach them the kinds of skills that all people need to have. Drugs cannot teach you coping skills. They cannot teach you social skills. They cannot build a support network for you. They cannot change your history. They cannot do the things that people need the most help with. And so that's why a good psychotherapist is worth their weight in platinum. The problem is that there aren't enough good psychotherapists to go around. And so people really need to be educated. It's why, you know, I've written now more than a dozen books, and most of them are for the profession. But there are two books that I wrote for the general public. One is called Depression is Contagious, and the other one is called Breaking the Patterns of Depression. And I wrote those because there's so much great research that never reaches the people who most need to hear about it. Mm. So these are the books that I wrote to make that contribution of helping people get in touch with the fact that there's a lot of good science about what works in treatment. And as I said earlier, there isn't any one form of treatment, but the common denominator of good treatments is they're active and they focus on empowering people to develop the skills they need to manage life on life's terms.
And you have brought us to the end of the show beautifully. Just beautifully. Michael, what an amazing conversation. You know, and I think that your view on all of this is, as you say, it's empowering back to the person, and it allows us to participate in our own healing through being active in it rather than being passive and taking a pill and hoping for the best that never comes.
Exactly right. Yeah, but depression, depressed people are among the most disempowered there are. And the idea of wanting to empower people is really the heart of my message.
Oh, and aren't you an amazing man for doing that? And how lucky are we? Honestly, just fabulous. Michael,
thank you so much.
For our listeners and for our viewers, where can they get more of you? Because I'm sure you're going to be inundated with, or your website's going to be inundated with visits of people trying to download your papers and your blogs or your articles. Where can they find you?
Well, my website address is yapko.com, spelled YAPKO.com. And, of course, they can always go to Amazon and type my name in, and they'll find my books and materials there. And I'm, you know, frequently touring Australia. I'm in I'm in Perth at the moment. I'm frequently lecturing throughout Australia, and my teaching schedule is posted also on my website.
So the general public can come to your lectures?
Most of the lectures I do are for professionals only. Wow. Some of the lectures I do are for the general public.
Well, here's an invitation for you. We will be doing a Karen's Couch filming session live, and I would love to be able to invite you to come on the show live when you're in Australia. And we'll try and I'll talk to our producers and see if we can't get that to tee up the timing. But it would be wonderful if we could have you on the show with our live studio audience. And we
I'd be happy to do that.
And we can dive deeper into this subject with a lot more time. And, you know, question and answer, because I think that your whole approach to this is inspiring and it's necessary. We are desperately in need of alternatives that, unfortunately, the medical model isn't providing, not on a general scale anyway. You know, there are some doctors out there or some therapists out there who are progressive like yourself, but it's the minority. You know, it's the exception rather than the rule. And I think that we are paying the price for that in our ability to be empowered in, and participate in our own healing. Hands down, I think you're right.
Thank you. You know, I think that as we become more aware of all the social factors that contribute to depression, we'll come to the appreciation that this is a social problem that can't be treated medically any more than you can medically treat child abuse or poverty.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It makes so much sense. It makes so much sense. You're amazing. You're amazing, and I'm so grateful that we've had you on the show. Really, you've been amazing. You've been fabulous.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for spreading the word.
Thank you, Karen.
Great, great. Everybody, I encourage you guys to all go to Dr. Yapko's website and download everything that you possibly can. Now, I know that a lot of people who follow Karen's Couch and who follow me personally, who are watching the show or who are listening on podcast, I know that you guys have either had depression or know people who have experienced it. And I think that the most important thing that we can do, all of us, is to take the lead and be educated. Make informed decisions rather than making decisions based on what others tell us. I think that's got to be the beginning. We've got to start to take responsibility and participate in our own recovery, and also, you know, look at how we can participate in the recovery of the people that we love. And you know, I that's a whole other show. That's a whole other show. And we're definitely going to get Dr. Michael Yapko back on for that one, that's for sure. So I hope that you've enjoyed this show, and I hope that you've gotten some insights from Dr. Yapko. Make sure that you go to his website and hang around, because in just a second, I'm going to see you all the way over. Or it's not really all the way over. It's just over there on Karen's Corner. See you. Here we are in Karen's Corner, once again with the amazing Peter Audette answering your questions all about money. But this week it's actually my question, it's not yours, because it came up from our last conversation. We touched on negative gearing, and in that whole conversation, tax came up. And I've been hearing so much about, do I buy an investment, whether it's property or shares or whatever it is, to get a tax break? And I really want to find out from you, Pete, is getting a tax break enough of a reason to go after an investment that could potentially be a noose around my neck?
No.
That was easy.
And that's a wrap. No. No. It's a really good question. A tax deduction can be a reasonable sort of beneficial side effect of some of the things that you do when you're investing. But it shouldn't usually be your dominant purpose for it. The main reason for that is to get a tax deduction with your $1,
yep,
you have to spend it. So if you have borrowed to go into the stock market, as an example, you have to buy a dollar's worth of interest and you get a tax deduction. Had you have not bought that dollar's worth of interest, you would have paid tax at your normal marginal rate. So if you're on the 30 cents in the dollar tax bracket, you would have paid 30 cents.
And you still have 70 cents
about
left.
31.5, but we'll call it 30 for the purposes of averaging. But
that's
about
such a finance thing, yes, to say.
But you still get to keep your 70 cents.
Yeah.
So to get that tax deduction, you have to spend it on something, and the outcome of that something that you spend has to be something positive, because you've given away 30 cents of the tax officer's money, but you've given 70 cents of your money away. And so there has to be an outcome. It just can't be the tax deduction. So really good example, you borrow $200,000 to go into the share market. You borrow some money off your home and you invest it in the shares. The market will do what the market does over a period of time, and that's the subject of an entirely different 5 minutes.
It's a whole other show.
But what will happen is the bank will charge you, let's call it 6% interest on the $200,000. So it costs you $12,000 a year of your own money to keep that money in the market, and you'll get some dividends that come back to support it on the way through. But you've still got to spend your $12,000. Now, over any sort of period of time, if you don't get an economic benefit greater than what you've spent, it's not a positive outcome. So there has to be a reason for it. And the answer, the real answer to all of this is you don't start with the tax deduction. You start with what it is that you're trying to achieve, and maybe tax comes along the side.
So it sounds like if you are in that 30% tax bracket, but even if you're in that 40% tax bracket, regardless of really where you are, the majority of your money is still going towards an investment or something that has to be of value to you first, rather than the 30% return that you, well, not return, but the 30% tax break that you're going to get.
Yeah. Money spent is money spent. It doesn't matter whether you got a tax deduction for it or not. The really good thing to remember is the tax office doesn't take all of your money. Even at the highest marginal rate, they're only taking about 46%.
Mm.
I know that's a lot, but they're not taking all of it. You still get to keep what's left.
Yeah, yeah.
Tradies are a great one for going and buying new cars right towards the end of the financial year. They go and see their accountant. Their accountant says, mate, you've made a lot of money this year. Go and buy another vehicle and get some more tax deductions. The point I think you should always make is, do you need another vehicle? Do you really need to spend the money? Because if you don't, and you pay the tax, you get to keep all the money that's left.
Rather than
just handing it over for more interest on another car. I accept the fact that you get the tax deduction and you get the new car, but if you didn't really need the car,
you've still spent that money.
You've still spent the money that you could otherwise save. And if you use it always as the catalyst for how you make decisions, then you forget to actually have a dominant purpose for anything. If you start with a goal and then chase some tax efficiency, knowing what your goal is and knowing the style of investment that you're looking for, tax can be part of the equation.
But
if you start with tax, it's not a goal. Saving money from tax is not a goal. It's just a thing that you do.
Yeah. And I love how you say start with the goal and then go after the tax efficiency.
Absolutely.
Because I think, certainly, for a lot of conversations that I've had over the years, the opposite is always the experience where we go for the tax break and we go for the tax efficiency and we think, yeah, I'll get that new car, or yeah, I'll spend that money on the business, or I'll invest that in myself, or I'll spend that on a property or on shares. But it's counterintuitive, really. And you know what I think, too? I think that sometimes all of the information out there can get a little bit confusing, and you've simplified it. Have the goal of what you actually need and want, and then go after the tax efficiency. I love it.
Yep,
high five to you. Nice work. Peter or Deb, joining us again on Karen's Corner, answering all of your questions when it comes to money. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Great to see you.
Join us here again next week on Karen's Couch. But before I sign off, I want to remind you guys, jump down underneath this video and post all of your comments and all of your questions. Anything that you want to ask Pete, let us know and we'll make sure that we get them answered for you. Go to our Facebook page at allthews.facebook.com/Karen's Couch and post your comments and questions there also. And when you go to iTunes and you listen to this podcast, give us a 5-star rating and tell everybody that you know about it, because Karen's Couch rocks. We're going to see you right here next week. Thanks for tuning in. Bye for now.